Welcome to 20 Years of 24 podcast. We're back with Deborah Manwiller. Welcome to the show. You played a big role and a very important role in 24. You were the casting director in 24, and you've cast the best actors and actresses on any show ever produced. I mean, 24 is still talked about 20 years later, and that's because of the awesome casting and the awesome characters created. You did an amazing job casting 24, and we appreciate it as super fans. So we want to thank you from the bottom of our hearts.
We love the super fans.
How did you get involved with the 24 franchise as a casting director?
It's funny because I actually replaced someone. I replaced the original casting director, and they were about 3 weeks in, maybe 2 or 3 weeks in, and a pilot is a crazy process and totally in a time crunch, even in the best of circumstances. So I came on and they didn't have anyone cast yet. They put the offer out to Kiefer the day that I came on board, because I remember they asked me what I thought about it and what my opinion was. And, you know, everyone has, I say, like, the in the beginning, everyone can write a list. Everyone has the same names on a list. So he's somebody, you know, can't necessarily say that I wouldn't have thought of Kiefer, or I would have. A lot of those names come up, and he was certainly making the rounds. He hadn't done much television at that point, nothing that had really made it to air, a couple of pilots. So yeah, that's how I came on. I came on board, and it was fast and furious and crazy. And then we started, you know, booking people, with the last actor that was booked literally, like, had to go on set and wardrobe and, like, work within, I think she worked the same day. I could be wrong. That was Sarah Clark. You'd have to ask her.
Oh, was Sarah?
Yeah, if memory serves me, she had to go. She had to wardrobe. I knew she had to wardrobe that day.
And what a crucial character. I mean, my goodness.
Like, usually we
right down to the wire.
It gets cut close, but usually not quite that close. a little bit heart-stopping.
We're scheduled to talk to her tomorrow. We talked to Xander a couple weeks ago.
And Sarah, I said hello, and Xander, actually just talked to him the other day. You know, awesome. That's the thing. I got to make a lot of friends, you know, both in front of and behind the camera that, you know, I've remained friends with for all these years. It's nice. And Sarah, and of course, Xander, and Shane, and Matt. So
amazing.
Not on the show.
I mean, Justin started asking that question pretty much from day one when we started doing this, and starting with the question of how did you get to 24? And the more we ask that question, we get so many diverse stories of how people wound up. You know, like Carlo Rota has a different story how he got on the 24 than Alicia. Alicia told us a story of how she got on the 24.
I want to hear how the actors said they got on 24.
Carlo had the Nikita. He had done, because he's Canadian, and he had done, and so he said he called Joel. And the story, I can't wait till we release that one, because he said, I got to LA from Canada, and I started calling everybody I knew. And he said, all his friends were like, you can't do that. You're not allowed to, that's not how you play the game. And they tried to talk him out of it. And he said he talked to Joel, and Joel basically said, well, we'll find a place for you. We'll make that happen.
Great. It's funny. We hired a lot of Canadians. You know, as I say, we outed all the Canadians.
And, absolutely. Was that intentional?
It just sort of, I mean, you know, because Joel and Bob had worked on Nikita in Canada, and also right. John Cassar was from Canada, if you haven't talked to John yet. So the people that they knew from things they'd been working on recently, a lot of them, you know, were from Canada. And then it just, like, it just made me laugh. I didn't realize how many Canadian expats there really were here. People that I didn't even realize had been here, you know, that were still going back and forth from Canada. So yeah, there are still a lot, but especially at that time, I think that was kind of like one of the first huge waves of people.
I mean, there's a lot of secret Canadians out there. We're Canadian. I'm in Windsor, right across from Detroit.
And I'm from the Hamilton area.
All the nicest people are Canadian.
Oh, thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's interesting. I did a lot of research, kind of looking into some things. And when I looked, I saw that you're attached to pretty much every episode. Kiefer's attached to every episode, and Sean Callery. But that's it.
I was going to say, I think Sean and I, and are we the only two?
And I guess Joel.
But I was going to say, out of crew, we might be the only two. We should talk about that, because we're the only ones there. The attrition rate could be pretty high there.
Well, yeah.
Well, certainly in front of the camera, it was like, you know, killed people left and right.
Yeah.
Sometimes the attrition rate could be kind of tough behind the scenes too. But no, Sean is a.
Yeah, you're like the Five Timers Club on Saturday Night Live.
Right. We're like SNL, we're like the original gang.
When you got 24, what was the impact it had on you working with that show?
I mean, it was a great gig, and you never know when you do a pilot. It's like, right. This was fun, and you know, it's always a gift when it gets picked up. But when I read it, and especially at that time, that was before people were, you know, people weren't downloading series and wasn't binging. And
24, right.
First thing, at least that I can remember, because I've been doing this for a minute, that mm-hmm. was really watched in that way.
Yeah.
And those DVD sets saved us. That's what kept us coming back year after year. I mean, that was like a marketing genius thing that they did, because then people could watch it, you know, like four or five at a time and binge it. So like, I think we were kind of the original binge show. But when I read it, I was struck by it was really an original idea, and it was a great, you know, great ride from the very first script, from the pilot. So, you know, it was just so much fun to be involved with from the get-go, and to keep on it. And one of the things that, especially being involved in all the seasons, you know, like some of the actors, you know, were only on for a few seasons just because their characters died, or, you know, they were doing a different storyline. But it was like working on a new show every year, because we literally recast a pilot and did a whole new show. It was more of an anthology show
with
eight different seasons.
Without actually being an anthology. Yeah, it was an anthology while being a continuing story, which is, I never thought of it until you said that.
So, and it's funny, because I had friends or people would say, you know, do I have to go back and watch from the beginning? I'm like, well, you don't really have to. I mean, I think it's just like with anything, noise, it makes it richer. And then there's, you know, little Easter eggs and things that references that they make. But I think that you could watch each season as a standalone. You know, it's hard for me. I can't erase those things that I'm out of my mind. But I do think that some of the seasons probably stand, you know, better on their own than others. But I think you could watch it that way. But I'm glad people didn't. I'm glad people stayed for the long haul, for the ride.
Stayed up at 4 a.m. five in the morning watching.
You know, creatively, it was a great gig. It was a great gig with great people.
Yeah.
And like I said, it was just something, and it was, you know, I wasn't casting, you know, the same role every year and every season, though we did have our share of the CTU officers, and like, you know, we had our buckets of roles that were, you know, in every season. I probably cast a bunch of people that said, down, man down, go. People there with the, you know, going around with their guns and talking, or, you know, people that were in the CTU going, let me find him. We're triangulating the area, or whatever.
Yeah, and again, learning that dialogue, we've heard that, you know, from a lot of different people, the idea of having to get up to speed to be able to recite the tech dialogue, and certainly the tech dialogue, even tech has changed so much since in 20 years. I mean, my goodness, the idea that if I'm in the car, I can be watching 24 on my phone. If somebody else is driving, of course, but I can watch 24 on my phone. And the idea of doing that is hilarious, considering where season one started.
Yeah.
Right.
I hadn't really thought about that, but yeah, I mean, it's like light years away from, you know, from what was happening 20 years ago. That's pretty wild to think, you know, we were so cutting edge 20 years ago, even just in the technology. Although, and the thing that people used to always joke about, I'm sure somebody has said it already, that, you know, there was always great cell reception, except for maybe once or twice in the entire series, always could get a cell connection, but no bathrooms and no eating.
Yeah. Well, that's you know, in the off scenes, that stuff, we figured that stuff happens in the off scenes. Yeah. There is the one scene.
It was a gag reel.
Yeah. I think it was season 8. When we come in on season 8, Jack's asleep on the couch.
Yeah.
I think that's the only time I can remember him actually being voluntarily asleep.
Yeah.
We didn't introduce you as Emmy winner. I apologize, because when we go back to Emmy.com has a page for you that lists exactly which years, and so we looking at 1996. You know, you're competing against Frasier and Seinfeld. I mean, super heavy hitters. And then of course in 2004, Sopranos and West Wing. So congratulations. We're a little late. We apologize, but congratulations.
That's
on.
Okay, I'll
yes,
take
congratulations.
And what does that do? What does that do for you? Does that make your life easier being an Emmy winner?
I mean, you know, we're different than actors. We're kind of like journeymen. We don't, it's nice. You get to put in a resume and you can, you know, I have them on my mantle and, you know, right. It's nice. You get to say that. And I suppose, you know, when you die, they say you were an Emmy winning, whatever. I just think that work does beget work, and the calls happen, you know, a little more frequently when you're on something that's hotter, for sure. And, you know, like I said, this was kind of at the beginning of, you know, this binge television and appointment television and sort of like the real high end. It's like The Sopranos, certainly at the beginning of HBO being, you know, HBO.
Yeah, right. Yes. So, I remember when HBO was HBO. And it was,
right.
Yeah. So that's all changed.
That part of it, you know, that part's nice. But for casting directors, we're, you know, especially those that, you know, I'm not on staff at a studio or network, and we're sort of true independents, and we're like actors. We go from job to job also. So
you weren't tempted to bring it in and set it down on the table during a casting call?
I did threaten. There was a Shelley Winter story that she actually went into some studio executive with her Emmy in a bag and brought it out at one point. There's only one producer I really, and wasn't on 24, that I really, really wanted to do that with, someone who wasn't nice. So I did bring it and put it up on my shelf one day.
Sort of. That's a good...
Passive aggressively.
As you should. When it's there for the moment. When you need it, it's there.
Nice to be invited to the dance.
Awesome.
What I would say, just about a good gig, and then, you know, getting, you know, I'm happy behind the camera, and so all those other things, they're really nice, but, you know, it isn't the reason that, you know, that I like
that you show that you come to work every day.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right. Did you grow up watching TV?
I did, but, you know, I'm older than both of you. My kids, you know, were laughing the other day. I'm like, you know, when I was a kid, you know, there were three channels. I mean, there wasn't a Fox.
Well, I'm going to be a grandpa in a couple weeks.
Get out.
Stop. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, I remember the three channels. Plus in Canada, we had CBC. So we had four.
Okay. So you had four.
I remember.
And I don't, you know, I didn't grow up. I grew up in a really blue collar family, and certainly, you know, not in the arts. I went to get my degree in theater, you know, at a performing arts, CalArts.
Okay.
To the arts, which, you know, I say it's like fame only college. Very sort of demeaning way to describe it, but it's a very, you know, small liberal arts school here in Southern California. And it just wasn't, you know, I didn't grow up, you know, I didn't go to a Broadway play until I was in college. I didn't, you know, right. I didn't grow up, you know, having, you know, parents that were, you know, going and finding, you know, documentaries on PBS. It was a very kind of blue collar house. I watched the Flintstones and the Twilight Zone and those kind of things growing up.
So yep, me too.
I found my love of, you know, of cinema and theater and all those things in college. You know, I took, you know, film courses and devoured that kind of stuff. So I sort of, you know, got bitten by that bug because I wanted to be an actress. And so I got bitten by that bug in college.
Well, I try to explain to my kids that, you know, at dinner time when my mom would call for dinner and we had to be at the table at a particular time, it was usually at the like 5:20 mark. So whatever show I was watching, usually The Monkees or The Brady Bunch, whatever show I was watching, it wasn't like I could pause it and come back. And my kids have no concept of that.
No idea.
It wasn't. There was no chance it was going to come back around for at least another year. But dinner was calling, and you, if you want to eat, you got to get to the table. So yeah, those are the hardships that I endured. Not real hardships, but you know, certainly you couldn't pause the TV and come back to it later.
No,
I quite like that now. What excites you about casting a show?
I mean, the best thing is when you're reading something and, you know, the writing is good enough that you start to picture where you are.
Right.
You start to see the world. You start to envision the world, and that there's, you know, good, you call it, you know, meat on the bone for the characters, and they're drawn out so that, you know, I start to picture them. It's just like when you read like a great novel and the descriptions are happening and it's happening through the story. And so when I read a script, if I start to picture people, or if I start to see it, and sometimes it might be people I know, or sometimes it might be people that, you know, I just met last week, or, you know, but if I can start to see that character, and, you know, the best part is bringing people into the room and, you know, doing that part of it. you know, to watch people bring something to life and to bring, you know, to breathe life into these words that, you know, so much, you know, better or different or something I hadn't thought of that, you know, that even I had imagined.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds to me like you immerse yourself in a world that doesn't exist, right? You immerse yourself in a world that isn't visual. There is no CTU when you're trying to cast the show. You can't see the building of CTU to say, okay, this is how they're going to work. So you have to, it sounds like you have to visualize that. You have a lot of time to sit down with the creator to kind of flesh that out before you can start the casting process?
I mean, certainly on this, it was, you know, crazy, crazy, crazy town. But in general, there's really not that much time, the luxury of that time. You get more in the feature world than you do in television just because of the pace of it. Okay. You know, on a series, you're getting your scripts like every 8 days or every 10 days or whatever the cycle of the scripts are. Mm-hmm. And during that time, you know, you have to, so you have to kind of buy in into what the producers and the writer are sort of trying to, the story that they're trying to tell very quickly, kind of get into their heads about what characters might, you know, what's the most important thing about the character, or just kind of talk about the, you know, the qualities that's, you know, is it like Brad Pitt in this movie?
Try to narrow it down so you have a picture of what they're looking for.
Right,
sure.
Jump in and key into what they're looking for very quickly, because there isn't a lot of time. Especially, you know, the more that the industry has progressed, casting gets more and more squeezed. I'm sure if you talk to the editors, they have the same complaint, like, because the things that happen in pre-production and in post-production, those two things are more crunched than ever.
Right.
Time periods, for sure.
Well, I remember the discussions around when Kevin Bacon started doing The Following, and it was, I think it was Kevin Williamson that basically said, we wanted Jack Bauer. Like, they weren't being coy about it. They said, we want Kevin Bacon to be the next, you know, or that type of character. So they weren't hiding it. So as you said, if you can frame it in a way that people can understand, okay, what exactly are you looking for? Please tell me, because
prototypes, and just to kind of, you know, so that there's a frame of reference. And, you know, that's something, you know, that's nice when you do work with a team for a long period of time. Like, if you're on for several seasons, you develop a shortcut with the producers, especially, you know, John Cassar, who was our main director for so many of the episodes and later in the
season. Sure.
And you begin to develop kind of a shorthand with those people, and also, you know their taste. Not everybody has the same taste, and you learn, oh, I'm not going to bring up that actor again. That's right. They don't like them, or they love so-and-so, or, you know, it's just a familiarity and a shortcut away, you know, when you work with people, just like all the other, you know, daily departments, I'm sure echo sort of the same thing when you get to work with the same team for a long period of time. That's
Well, you know, it's interesting. We talked to Howard Gordon 3 weeks ago. He mentioned too, you know, he said there's a lot of things in a pilot that could go wrong. But, you know, with 24, the magic of 24, a lot of it was the casting.
Absolutely.
Of all the actors and actresses that you casted. So I think that's what contributed to the magic of 24. And why it's still popular 20 years later. And I mean, 24 Live Another Day, the revival after 4 years was a big success. What are your thoughts? What do you think, you know, do you think 24 is a show that could easily be revived today in this day and age, considering Jack's story was left open?
Maybe. I mean, you know, part of it, I think sometimes the conceit was at that time super original, and there's certain things that are of a time. I'm not saying that it couldn't, but that alchemy of that time at that story, you know, at that point in history with those actors, you know, I the conceit, it's a great idea to do it online. That's a, you know, it's a great framework for any show.
Yeah.
But I think you'd have to be really careful about how you sort of remade it. And I think they've talked about it a number of times over the years, I'm sure, Howard, you know, and they've all discussed, you know, what would be the reason to come back, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
What would make it different enough to make the audience want to tune in, and what would, you know, and some of the actors maybe want to come back. But, you know, what's the reason to write that? Is there something in the zeitgeist in popular culture or in the world, or, you know, I think that, like, what makes people, you know, tune in? I mean, the 24-hour premise, I think that's a great place to start, but I still don't know if it's enough. You know,
right.
24 still.
Right, and Howard said that to us too. He goes, you know, I mean, he said they would all love to do another 24, and Kiefer has said he would love to do 24 again. And but
there has to be a compelling reason.
The consistency was that the idea has to be great. It has to have a real pulse, and it has to live up to the legacy and of the show, and honor the fans of the show. Yeah, but I mean, but I mean,
the bar is very high.
But Manny Cotto, who was interviewed in November, said, you know, Jack's story was left very open at the end of Loop Another Day, that, you know, there is an opportunity there to kind of build off, you know, where Jack ended up in Russia, sort of thing, and, you know, what happened to Jack. So, I mean, hopefully that gets resolved one day.
It could. I mean, if it could be done, you know, if everybody found a story that felt like it was the one to bring back.
Yes, yeah.
Because it's still, the idea is still, you know, a great idea that nobody has really, you know, it hasn't, and nobody's tried to do it again.
Right.
Yeah. There have been rip-offs, and although they did take the 24, ding, you know, they've stolen that ad nauseum, but the story.
I think what you've done from a casting standpoint has been spectacular and superb.
Like I said, I feel really lucky to have, you know, it was like doing kind of eight movies, you know.
Right.
Season. In fact, a lot of the episodes, we used to say we're making like a movie every, you know, 24 movies in a year, because they really were, you know, a lot happened in those hours, and just the scope of, you know, car, you know, plane crashes and cars and people, you know, on the run. And there were a lot of, you know, it was like an old fashioned serial. When I read it, and I realized, oh, this is the conceit that every week there's a cliffhanger.
Yeah.
It's like old fashioned serials from the 50s.
Exactly. That they watched in the theaters.
That's what it was.
Yeah.
It was such a great idea. But the in the casting of it, I have to say that, you know, you kind of go back about what you asked about how do you, you know, you get a lot of time, and, you know, they talk about the roles and things. And the thing that was different about 24 that I've never had before and never had since is that they didn't, in the earlier seasons, they sort of gamed out where they were going to go from beginning to end, and they had a pretty clear idea. But in the later seasons,
writing on the fly, from what we've heard,
it was definitely. I mean, Howard Gordon told me once, he said it was like putting a puzzle together of the piece of the sky, where all the puzzle pieces were like blue or white. You just kept having to look for it, and I was like, oh, that's exactly what it was like. I would go up into the writer's room and try to get tidbits about what they might be thinking about. Because the thing about the casting was that we could have somebody who might just have a small scene, but then that character might be like the ultimate bad guy, or they might be some really, really important role. And we got pretty good about reading a script and going, oh, this role, this one, I can tell this one's going to, you know, turn into something. And a lot of the time we were right, but we didn't know what it was going to turn into. So that's when, you know, traipse up to the writer's room and say, okay, so this one, like, what's this going to be? And they would come, you know, they would come to us and say, okay, we're going to have this role. This is going to be like a 6-episode arc. And this is going to be the person that we think's the bad guy, but they're not really the bad guy, or they help the bad guy, or the bad girl, or whatever it is. They're the mole. And they would be able to tell us some of what the character was going to be. But even so, because they didn't know what the story was going to be, we had to find people that kind of, you know, could do a lot of different things.
Right. Yeah.
What we were going to be asking them to do, and sort of it became sort of about, okay, well, this is, if they're going to inhabit the world of CTU, then okay, there's a certain kind of vibe. They need to, you know, the tech talk, you know, whatever it is, or if they're going to be the story that's more on location and it's on the run, or if they're going to be part of a political storyline, or sort of not knowing what the actors are going to be asked to do. And the actors, I'm sure, echo this too. They most of the time didn't, you know, they didn't know a lot about what they were going to be doing. And
right. Yeah.
I used to think that would freak them all out, but I think it's almost better if they don't know, because then you have to play things in the moment.
Right. Yeah.
Playing it for the thing you know is going to happen, or you think might happen, and you really confidence, and then the surprises and the turns, you know, can, you know, really come up in an authentic way for the actor too. So. Yeah.
The podcast itself is supported by the 24 Universe group on Facebook. It's about 12,000 mm-hmm. people. Actually, when we started 2 months ago, we had 10,000. But with Disney Plus, I think we're getting people all over the world that are discovering the show for the first time. And the cool thing about this page is that we will go on. Part of the purpose of it is to keep everybody informed as to what everybody's doing. So we'll get on, we'll say, hey, Roger Cross is doing Corner on CBC, or Xander's doing this movie, or Carlo's in here. So it's a lot of, like, pretty much there's at least 3 or 4 posts every single day that brings people.
I don't have to go on. I like to keep track of the 24.
Yeah. People. Yeah. I mean, for us, 24 is a pedigree and a level of excellence that when we see that somebody else that's involved in the show is doing something else, we want to at least, as we said, there's so much TV right now. We're long beyond the days of 3 channels. There's 8 million shows to choose from. I want to know if Roger Cross is on it. Okay, there's a level of credibility that, you know, if Roger's involved, it must be worth checking out. And so in so many ways, you had a real ability to find people that went on to build careers after 24, which is pretty amazing. Pretty amazing. Because they're directing. You know, everybody's doing something different. And they've all moved out and they're active in the business.
Nice to see. It's gratifying. And, you know, it's just great to see everybody's kept working. And I'm so happy that Sarah and Xander met on the show.
Is there a casting decision that you... that you look at and you go, we nailed that one. We got that perfectly.
I mean, there's a lot of people I love. I really, one of my favorite characters was Greg Itzen, who played our sort of Nixonian president. I really loved, you know, what he did with that.
Yes.
It was such an original thing, and it was all him, and he's just this, you know, really great, you know, character actor, journeyman actor who's been around, you know, for a long time and had a, you know, sustained, wonderful career of all kinds of great roles. And you know, couldn't be a nicer person, nicer human being to boot. So, you know, that I love that character in particular, and James Morrison, and, you know, some of these people, like I said, they became friends of mine, or I mean, I might have been friends with them before just because from the connection from the show, which was really a kind of a special place. You know, just because we were all together for a long time.
I lit up when you said Nixonian, because when he appeared on screen for the first time, that's the first place my mind went. I went.
I have that turned up nose, and it wasn't, you know, part wasn't, you know, intended. You could ask Joel. I don't remember that being in the character description, but maybe it was. But just because, you know, he was just a good actor, and the fact that, you know, people thought that, you know, he looked like that or had that echo from the very beginning, that's just a bonus.
Here's the flip side of that same question. Was there one you had to fight for that you're glad you stuck with it?
James Morrison was one of the people we had to sort of fight for. I will also tell you, it's a dirty little secret, but that we replaced a lot of people on the show.
Okay.
Like from small roles into big roles. And I'm not going to tell, I won't air dirty laundry about whoever there, but the first few times we did it, I was like, oh my God, we're gonna fire so-and-so. And none of these people were bad. I mean, there's some really, really, really good actors.
Right.
And it was all in service of, you know, it's just not what, it wasn't fueling the story. It wasn't what a couple of the writers, particularly, you know, would have in mind for something certain. And they just, it wasn't about somebody not doing good work. But the first time, a couple of times it happened, I mean, as a casting director, that's like your worst nightmare. You get bad report from somebody on the set, or that they're going to let somebody go that you've hired. And I was like, man, this is it. I'm going to get fired. I'm going to get canned. This is terrible. It's happening to him. And I realized it happened way more than on anything I've ever been on. And part of it, I think, was due to the nature of the show, because they didn't necessarily know what the person would be asked to do. And then they'd get some, you know, start looking at dailies and go, oh no, we're 2 more episodes down the line. We know we're going to need them to do. And so they would replace. But that was strange. Those actually hit harder than anything else. It's like, oh, that's a tough call to have to make. That's a tough call.
Sure.
James almost ended up in that pile, and he knows that.
What's fascinating about that is that we just released James's interview today, and he schooled us. Like we felt like students when he was talking, because he talked about serving the story, and he took us on a journey of serving the story and how important it was. He talked about auditioning for every iteration of Star Trek there ever was and not getting any of them. And he said, but what I learned through that process was it's all about serving the story. So when you tell us on your end that he almost wasn't on the show, I mean, that noble death still of all the noble deaths that happened on 24, boy, that is still heartbreaking to watch, because one of the things we discussed and I asked was there's no dialogue at points between you and Kiefer, and what you're not saying is huge. Like watching that scene again, it's moving.
I love those deaths. I also, the other thing too, which was, it wasn't done that much on shows at that time, especially when we were starting to kill main characters, you know,
right.
Them, you know, not just to write them off, but like to kill them and like, yeah. Or them to do something terrible and they would leave in disgrace. That was sort of unusual. And so the first couple times they did, I'm like, oh, that's so horrible. And then I realized, oh no, we're going to be doing this a lot.
the rules are different on this set.
So yeah, some of the I think they, like a gag reel exists somewhere, or you know, a reel about, you know, these 24 deaths, and they were, you know, you'd lose people that, you know, these characters that you love, but that's, you know, I know. And I didn't watch very many of the dailies. I would watch it. I watched it with my husband. Mm-hmm. Because I watched it as a fan, I would wait and try really hard not to watch too much of it. I wanted to see the final product, and I would watch it, you know, either in the DVD sets, or I would watch it, on air, in real time.
Yeah, yeah. No, the people that we've talked to, we're, I think, 30, 31 at this point, mm-hmm. and we asked the ones that definitely are dead, or at least seem to be dead, we said, do you regret dying? Eric Balfour was a great one. Do you regret? He said, no. He said, no. He said, it was an honor to go. If I'm going to go, I'm going to go like that. Like,
yeah, it's like a bet. That's the thing, is like, everybody knew that, you know, it was kind of a, you know, a job hazard.
It kind of, yeah. Like, yeah.
When you came on the show, it was like, this might not be for the entire season. Certainly.
Yeah. And we have yet to talk to anybody that begrudges the way they died, because they felt it was, served the story.
Yeah, that's a good point to make. But I mean, that's what all of it was, you know.
Right, right.
All of the choices, and then the people that came and went in storylines. But there were people, you know, it's funny too. Marilyn Rashkab, that was such a sort of nothing character in the beginning. I remember reading, and it wasn't nothing character, but it was like, oh, this is, we're going to plug this person into the CDU. Right. I understand this is kind of like the tech girl, or you know, who'll be some, you know, maybe some comic relief, as much as we could ever get, you know,
or right irony. Lighten the room a little bit,
irony in this to you. I'm like, oh, this role will, you know, it will probably, you know it'll be a season and then it'll go away. And then, you know, Joel just fell in love with her, and just, you know, he really, really wanted to write for her, and I thought it was great, just because it's a character we hadn't seen before, and especially as a woman, and yeah. And she's this sort of like this quirky
yeah character. Did you know her before she came in?
Yeah, and she had done
Mr. Show. I was a fan from Mr. Show.
But Punch Drunk Love had just come out too.
That's right.
That's,
I forgot.
You know, we were talking about, you know, when we cast her, and she's named after my daughter.
Oh, wow. No, I forgot about Punch Drunk Love. That.
Yeah, she was great.
It's not a movie people talk about, but boy, she was a crucial part. She was one of the sisters, right? She was. Mm-hmm. Boy, yeah, I forgot about that. That was probably the other one where, again, she comes on, and from what we understand, she wasn't probably going to be on for very long. But we've had discussions about how, by the end, she's the heart of the show in many ways.
I know, she really was, because there were years when, you know, they would go back, and especially, you know, I'd get the script for the first, you know, episode of the next season, and I'm like, okay, what are we, who's still there?
Right, yeah, who's still alive?
we wouldn't always know, even if they were alive, we wouldn't necessarily know if they were going to be coming back.
Right.
Until, you know, right before, or even if they were coming back, that they might be in the first episode, then they might be gone. And I was always, you know, holding my breath to see if Chloe would still be back, because, you know, everybody loves Chloe.
I'm just realizing I can ask you this question and there's nobody else I could have asked this, and you don't have to, you can plead the fifth. But I remember during the filming of Live Another Day,
yeah,
I remember Mia Kirshner tweeting, "It's nice to be back on set." And I went, "Oh." And then it never happened. Did I dream that? And you don't have to answer if you don't want to.
I don't remember.
Okay. Fair enough. That's an easy out. I remember that tweet. Like, I followed her on Twitter, and I remember knowing that Live Another Day had been announced and it was in production, and I saw that, and again, one of my favorite characters on the entire series is Mandy.
Yeah.
Because we don't even know if Mandy was her real name. This last viewing, I went, oh, she could have just made that up. We don't even know. There's no real verification that that's even who she is.
That's true. Because I remember it was one of those characters that was hard to cast because we weren't sure what she was going to be or who
right,
she was.
Right. So. Yeah. I mean, the two characters that were probably most crucial to cast for season one would have been Mandy and Sarah and Nina.
Now, from a casting standpoint, how much of casting, of the casting, was the casting choices 100% totally up to the casting director, or how much say did like the network executives like Dana Walden, Gary Newman, Gail Berman, Kevin Reilly, Brian Grazer? How much
in the beginning, especially as the show, you know, for a pilot, the network is involved and we do these network tests and you bring a lot of different choices in. And then as the seasons, you know, began over again, you know, we had to approval from the network, certainly on, you know, bigger roles and, you know, sometimes have to test a couple of those characters. I mean, you know, to have to go through the whole process and have more than one choice. But, you know, the network had their eyes, you know, you have to get everything approved from one line to, you know, 100,000 lines. They want to look at it and have eyes on it. But, you know, the casting directors, we're kind of like, in some sense, we're sort of like editors.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we bring the selection of actors and we say, here's the people we love. And you know, part of our job is to edit so that you're not presenting 100 choices. You're saying, here are these five.
Right.
These five are great. I might be wrong about these five, or you might tell me, well, no, it's you're too far to the left of center, or it's a little bit more this, and then I can sort of recalibrate. But and especially on the show, the producers did not. They had a really short attention span for casting. Not like it just like because there were so many other things going on, and so I learned really early on. Peggy Kennedy, who's since passed away, but she and I did that show together. That we knew that, you know, they didn't like to spend a lot of time in casting, I guess is what I'm really trying to say. Besides
right,
Sean
right.
Cassar, loved casting, could have spent all of his days there. You know? I think he would say the same.
Yeah.
But casting is very time consuming. And yeah. So you do, and it's a really crucial part, but it's also a big time suck in the day when you've got our department meetings and location scouts and story meetings, all these other things.
Yeah.
So I think we were really judicious about the people that we would bring in. And so we would bring in a really carefully crafted session of like very few people and say, right. These are the ones we believe in. And we got, you know, pretty good at sort of figuring out what they might like and what might be best. And so we didn't have, you know, huge, you know, sessions and, you know, an immense amount of people for the roles. We're considering, you know, how important the roles were and how long some of them went for, you know, I look back and I think, wow, we really did sort of hone in on those choices, you know, fairly quickly. And at the beginning of the season is setting up, that's certainly a little bit longer process, but, you know, we, you know, brought the people that we thought would be best and then, you know, we recalibrate along the way.
And has the casting process changed where casting is done or how it's done, you know, with technology evolving with Zoom now becoming more popular? How has the casting process changed?
You know, in the positive things are that, you know, the world became a smaller place, and where I used to have to wait to get tapes, or I couldn't cast things in Australia or the UK or, you know, South Africa or wherever. It was just a lot harder to, you know, to upload. People weren't uploading files and sending things. It was like you have to get a DVD and mail it, and that's 20 years ago. That was still happening. I used to put out in breakdown services at the end of every season, please pick up your DVDs and your VHS tapes from your actors' demos. Hmm. And, you know, that doesn't happen anymore. So the world has gotten smaller in the sense mm-hmm. that so my pool has gotten bigger. Mm-hmm. And I have access to people that I wouldn't have had access to before, and they can send me a tape and I can set up a session, and then next morning I wake up and I can have the London selects from things that, you know, people have put themselves on tape or agents have submitted things from there. The thing that's harder is that because everything can happen in cyberspace, sometimes it does. Hmm. And the time that casting takes is, like I said, it can be a really time consuming process. And so producers are, it's one of the things that can kind of go out the window. All of a sudden it's like, well, you can't get these four people in a room. We're just going to, you know, we're going to have all these actors, you know, have their taped auditions. And that's that's for somebody, you know, like I said, because I've been doing it for a minute, and it's that part of it. I really hope that doesn't go completely by the wayside. In the time of COVID, it's been sort of necessary. I've cast things on Zoom, and it's weird. It's weird to have your auditions in Zoom, and we sit there and you admit people from a little waiting room, and you're doing your scene, and I'm doing it like I'm reading to you, and it's a weird thing, you know, to not have that energy with the other person in the room. But also just the whole, especially for younger actors that are just starting out, I think it's how actors get their barometer.
Right.
Like, the barometer from that feeling in the room, even though this and, you know, a film screen are how we view things and we see things, that exchange of energy and that sort of vibe that you get from people, for actors especially, to be able to read the room and to learn those things and to figure out, you know, that's a lot harder thing to do, and for young producers and directors too. I think, you know, I would hate to see that completely go by the wayside, and I get it, you know, there's a time and a place for things to happen in cyberspace, but I would be really sad if that went away altogether.
Sure. Yeah. Now I look at when I was preparing for today, I listed three TV shows: Episodes, Extras, and Entourage. Didn't think about the fact that they're all E's and it's alliterative, but they all kind of pulled the curtain back to some degree and showed the whole process to, you know, people that didn't know anything about TV and casting and film. Is there anything that was portrayed in popular culture of your role that may not be accurate?
Oh, we're always like, oh, it's so horrible. Like, the worst one is La La Land, right? Like, the terrible
thing
that happens. Like, I watch that.
Yeah.
So I would say most casting directors that have, you know, my job, like, I like actors. I love actors. I want to see people, you know, you want to see people succeed. You want to see people do their best work. You want to try to create an atmosphere where people feel, you know, comfortable enough to do their best, right? So I feel that usually, you know, but that doesn't play for laughs. So
the drama side of it.
The horrible parts where people are like, yeah, and I cannot say that those things are untrue. Sometimes I have rooms where I'm like, you know, horrified by things people will do. But, you know, part of my job is that, you know, I run an office and I get to run the room the way I want. And if somebody's really like, that's not going to happen. That's not going to happen on my watch. So, no.
Have you ever seen a portrayal that gets it right?
I have to stop. Usually it's played for laughs, man. I mean, sometimes it's like, you know, what is right is, you know, the actor angst part of it is that when you have like that table, and it's usually when they're doing like theater auditions and they're like in a terrible room where there's like just a table set up
right.
And they're looking at the headshots, and that part of it, you know, it's part of what it is. Right. And you're like, next. But I think what's missing mostly is sort of the human element, and it's missing the me, it's missing the, you know, the casting director, the person that's there, that's, walking out and saying hello to the actors and bringing them in and you know, saying, you know, giving, you know, a word of encouragement, or, you know, talking about when someone walks into the room and, you know, Xander or Jim or somebody, Morrison, yeah, walks in the room like, hey, did you see them in the episode of blah, blah, blah? Or they just did this great movie. That's part of my job too, is I want to create some excitement and to get the producers and directors excited about the person that I'm bringing in, educating them about the person that's going to walk in and read for them, so that they're not coming in blind too. So, you know, that's part of my job too. So, well, yeah.
Outside of the 24 universe, thank you. Outside of the 24 universe, is there another show or shows that you are especially excited about or proud of the work that you did for them?
I love, it was a really old one, but I really loved Picket Fences. That was like one of my favorite casting credits. And
love Picket Fences.
I was super, super proud of that one.
Yeah.
That one. And you know, it's funny, there are some other things that I've done that didn't go for very long. Oh my God, I'm totally blanking on the name of it that we cast Jeremy Renner in. It ran for 5 episodes in it, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
The Unusuals. Okay.
It was like 2009. That's a long time ago.
Okay. Yeah. Between Justin and I, we're kind of IMDb in our brain.
But... Yeah. Amber Tamblyn was the female cop in it.
Okay.
He was the lead in Harold Perrineau, and and Terry Kinney was in it. Adam Goldberg. It was a really great cast, and it was, it was one of those things that it was before there were, like, I think if it had been even 5 years later, or if that show belonged on cable.
Sure.
If it had been on cable, like, there was a weirdness to it, and it just, like, they tried to straighten out all the kinky lines in it, you know, on network television, and put it into this box that it didn't belong in.
Shouldn't have been in. Yeah.
That piece. So if you can ever go see those 7 episodes or 6 episodes, or whatever, that was a really, really good writing. Peter Tolan was one of the producers on that, from Rescue Me, and it was a really, really good one.
I think The Fix should have had a longer run.
The Fix. See, that's
Fix was great.
Like, not back. I'm like reaching too far back in memory. That was another one. I wish that had gone for longer. I was really proud of that cast. That was a great cast.
Robin Tunney. Like, it was.
I saw myself. That was a really good cast.
It was a great cast, and I was extremely disappointed when that one didn't get a longer run, for sure. Yeah. And the other one that I will draw attention to is Cabin Boy.
Oh my God! Oh, somebody bought it.
It is. Here's the greatest thing. It's so Kino Lorber put it out on Blu-ray finally, after people like me just hounding them. I think they call it early classics. The word classic is in the title of the series they put it out through, which I wholeheartedly agree with.
I used to have a poster of that, and then in our office moves, I lost it along the way. Cabin Boy. Oh my God! You know, it's really hard to take stuff off IMDb.
Melora Walters. When I saw her in Magnolia, I was like, she was in Cabin Boy. Like, there's far too many throwbacks from that cast. Oh, if you have a Cabin Boy story, I would. I did buy it because I love it, and I watched it when it came out. I was one of the 15 people that went to see it. I absolutely loved. I remember at the time Chris Elliott gave a speech. No, he was on Letterman because that was, you know, his thing. And Chris Elliott said, "You know, Mother Oscar always forgets her January babies." And I was like, "Of course, that's why you didn't get an Oscar." I know that's.
Wow.
So I'll shut up. Is there at least a Cabin Boy story?
I don't even have a good one. No. I'm sorry. I'm going to disappoint you. There, it was too long ago.
Did you enjoy it? Was it?
It was a really, you know, it was one of those things where when we were doing it, we didn't know what it was going to be. And
right.
It was what it was, and the script was weird and stuff. But, you know, one of the things we thought that the special effects and the weirdness, like it was 25 years or 20 years too early.
You're being generous.
The Tim Burton part of it, right?
That's
you wanted to do it. I'm like, this is going to be too cool. It's going to be this whole Tim Burton-y thing. And then it sort of was something different. But yes, it's a cult classic.
I love that movie. I love the David Letterman cameo. I've actually sat my kids down and tried to get them to watch it a couple times. And we get about 20 minutes in and they go, no, I can't. I can't go any further.
I don't know if I could, but I'm glad you did.
Oh, I did. Once a year we watch Cabin Boy. My wife has finally warmed up to it. So.
That's funny.
No, I had to bring that up because, like I said, on IMDb, you got to double check to make sure, but your name was like right in the beginning credits, right at the beginning of the movie. So it's a classic. It's been named a classic by Kino Lorber. So thanks for doing that, by the way. I from the bottom of my heart, I really do sincerely mean Cabin Boy is that's about the level of maturity that I have is Nathaniel Mayweather. Sorry, you were saying, Justin?
What advice would you give from your perspective to students coming out of school who want to get into the acting business? From a casting standpoint, what advice would you give? You know, like, what do you look for typically? What can students, you know, say someone is looking, you know, just got an agent and is looking for their first role?
It's funny because I teach some beginning acting classes sometimes at Loyola Marymount or at UCLA and guest for different things sometimes. And, you know, I love teaching students that are kind of still in it or just out of school to kind of, they're not jaded yet, right? And they have that perspective where they are kind of just starting out and they are eager to sort of, like, you know, and they have the stars in their eyes about how it's going to happen and how they're going to do it. And I wish I was joking, say, I wish that there was a magic bullet that I could give you or the magic potion, and there is not.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I always tell young actors is that I think in the beginning too, especially if you're like just out of drama school, you're kind of like trying to come and trying to make your mark, that everybody, there's this part of you that wants to show the world like everything you got. Like A to Z, right? Everything Shakespeare, you know, the one line is, you know, like, what's the backstory and all those things. And that you want to just show everybody the, you know, huge range you have. And I urge people when they're starting out to find their sweet spot, because the spaghetti approach, just throwing it out, seeing what sticks. I mean, sometimes it takes that to find your sweet spot, but to sort of embrace it. And if you get cast, and, you know, like every role you're going out for is an attorney or a cop or the best friend or the teacher, it's like to sort of embrace that part of it, like to sort of gain, it's where you gain your confidence, is sort of where you get your, you know, your get your sea legs. And it's not saying that you won't ever get to branch out from those roles and do those other things, but to be able to kind of like, you build your confidence, you build your intuition, you build, you kind of build your barometer, right? You can hit something out of the park, and then you kind of venture out a little further into the water and a little further. And I know that seems counterintuitive to kind of narrow the focus, but I think it can help, you know, when people are just starting out, because it is so daunting. Like, oh my God, how am I ever, you know, where do I start?
Right.
So, yeah. You know, and that's, you know, the part of casting, you know, too. It's like, you know, I'm not looking for someone like, not looking for another Brad Pitt or another Timothy Chalamet or, you know, another whoever. It, you know, looking for the, you know, who you are, the next person, you know, the next different thing, the next new thing. People, you know, to not second guess yourself and to sort of kind of go for that, your authentic voice.
Awesome. What a great way to wrap up our time. Thank you so much, Deb. We appreciate it.
I feel very blessed to have worked on it. And say hello to all the other people. Tell them Debbie says hi. Like I said, lifelong friends. Great, great people.
Typical barrister.